Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Graylin Hagler, senior pastor at the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, who examines why Americans remain so divided on issues of police accountability and race after a week of tragic violence. Author, activist, and journalist David Swanson, who summarizes the conclusions of the British Chilcot Iraq War Report and considers the lack of any similar inquiry here in the U.S. to investigate the conduct of the Bush administration. And Caitlin Parody, communications director with the group Toxics Action Center, who talks about the effort to incorporate climate justice mandates into the New England Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ethnic violence erupted in South Sudan in late June as victims reported attacks by army soldiers and fighters targeting neighborhoods in the city of Wau, where ethnic Fartit people live. A Fartit government worker told the Guardian newspaper, "We saw soldiers from the Sudan People's Liberation Army shooting at civilians. Dozens of civilians were killed in the attack, and 70,000 people were forced to flee their homes." The civil war in South Sudan, which began in December 2013, has been dominated by attacks on civilians. In the capital city of Juba, over 300 people were killed in early July in a weekend of battles between militias, some loyal to President Salva Kiir and others to Vice President and former rebel leader Riek Machar, raising new doubts of the durability of a 2015 peace agreement. A researcher based in South Sudan observed, "There is no peace deal, only delaying tactics by the government. The state is continuing its military operations against the predominantly non-Dinka people." In recent months, humanitarian groups have complained that the United Nations peacekeeping force in South Sudan has failed to safeguard civilians in designated protection zones. Doctors Without Borders condemned the ineffectiveness of the peacekeepers, stating the Blue Helmets failed to protect the civilians as the United Nations Security Council mandated they should. South Korean labor leader Han Sang-kyun of the Korean Federation of Trade Unions was sentenced to 5 years in prison after he organized a series of unauthorized protest rallies in 2015. The harsh sentence reveals a growing level of authoritarianism in the Asian nation. The government charged Han with 8 traffic and public safety violations, claiming the leader of the 800,000-member labor federation tried to incite violence by exhorting the crowd to march to the presidential palace during an anti-austerity protest. In response, riot police blocked streets and tried to disperse protesters with water cannons. After the rally, Han took refuge in the Jogye Buddhist temple, where he stayed for 24 days before turning himself in to police. Labor unions in South Korea have been in retreat since the late 1990s, when the government made it easier to fire workers and to hire casual employees. Today, 1 in 7 South Korean workers makes less than the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. President Park Geun-hye, the daughter of a former military dictator, outlawed a 200,000-member teachers' union for defending 20 activists who had been fired for union activity. One of Park's aides funneled funds from a big business lobby to a far-right group that routinely mounted counter-protests to rallies by union and political activists. Juvenile prisons have been part of the penal landscape for most of America's history. As far back as the early 1800s, reformers pushed for the removal of children detained in harsh prison conditions. New institutions were created for the detention of youth in what were then called houses of refuge. But the new juvenile prisons failed, as they became overcrowded fortresses riddled with abuse. So reformers again advocated for change, establishing new youth camps or youth development centres, but harsh conditions remained. According to The Nation magazine, juvenile justice reform did make progress in 2015. Some state legislatures moved aggressively to remove young people from adult prisons. But despite those efforts, today some 10,000 youths are held in adult prisons where they are 5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than in juvenile institutions. Juvenile justice reformers are hoping to move public opinion to support the closing of large youth prisons and expand alternatives to incarceration, such as probation and counselling services. Critics complain that a prison environment, isolated from family and community, results in trauma, more recidivism, and a pipeline into the adult criminal justice system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
After 2 years of focus on police violence, protests, and debate, America just witnessed a tumultuous week, which began with the police shooting deaths of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Both incidents, documented in part on smartphone video recordings, went viral across American social media and around the globe. The police shootings of these two African-American men were followed by the murder of 5 police officers and the wounding of 7 others in Dallas, Texas, during a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest march. The sniper attack was carried out by a lone U.S. Army veteran who told police negotiators before his death that he was angry about recent police violence. In remarks made in Dallas during a memorial service for the slain officers on July 12th, President Obama said, "Hope does not arise by putting our fellow man down. It is found by lifting others up. And that's what I take away from the lives of these outstanding men," he said. "I believe our sorrow can make us a better country. I believe our righteous anger can be transformed into more justice and more peace." But other voices on the right were not on the same page as the president. Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh declared that activists in the Black Lives Matter movement were terrorists. And former Republican New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani asserted that the Black Lives Matter movement is inherently racist and that the group puts a target on the backs of police officers. Following the police shootings, Black Lives Matter protests were held in dozens of cities across the U.S., with the participation of tens of thousands. In some cities, civil disobedience actions resulted in hundreds of arrests. Your reporter spoke with Graylin Hagler, senior pastor at Washington, D.C.'s Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ. Here, Reverend Hagler examines why Americans remain so divided on the issues of police accountability and race after a week of tragic violence.
We have to thank Black Lives Matter for remaining in the streets and remaining in people's faces and continuing to press the issue and to lift up the issue and to carry on strategies and confrontations that continue to remind the overall society that things are not well and that there are things that have to be addressed. Because one thing that most Black people and people of color understand in this country does not talk about race unless it's forced to talk about race. That is America's best kept secret, but at the same time, America's greatest sin. Is that they do not talk about their greatest sin, and they try to make it something else, and they try to deny that there is any racism involved, and they want to call it something else. And that's part of the problem, is that America has never confronted its problems with race and its issues around racism.
Reverend Hagler, following the most recent police shooting deaths of the Black men in Minnesota and Louisiana, the debate in this country often devolves into a divisive and polarized argument where many people believe they have to choose sides to either support the Black Lives Matter protesters or support the police. But of course, there is another option. People can support the police and support changes in our system of policing that will reduce this kind of police violence and the feeling of many people in poor communities that the police are an occupying army.
People don't have any problem supporting the police as long as the police are engaged in righteous actions. In the eyes of the Fraternal Order of Police, police never do anything wrong, and that's part of the problem. Everybody in the police departments are not correct. Everybody in the police department is not biased, right? I mean, you know, the fact is that there's always a diversity, and clearly people have to call it for what it is, and unfortunately, part of the polarizing discussion and the debate becomes those who protecting law enforcement, those who are representing law enforcement, are basically arguing to the extreme and pretending as if there's nothing wrong in the police department. Also, we've witnessed over the last number of years the radical militarization of civilian police departments, and what I mean domestic police departments. For example, what happened in Dallas should be really of concern to folks, that you put a bomb on a robot that went in and blew somebody up. That should be really real concern. Where did the bomb come from? Is the bomb stored in a warehouse somewhere? What else is stored in a warehouse somewhere? We should all be asking these questions, because this is part of the problem why police are seen as an occupying army, because of the severe militarization that goes on. And the fact is that if you got it, you're going to use it. And unfortunately, it's been used too much.
Well, just a final question for you, Reverend Hagler, and that is, as you look at the national Black Lives Matter movement dispersed across hundreds of cities all across this country, what would be your priority in terms of organizing for action and a list of demands in terms of the situation in our country today?
Well, I think that you got the list of demands obviously should be to really construct a whole model of community policing. Two, that the police departments be under the scrutiny of the federal government, of an agency in the federal government, where they will have to report gun discharges, have to report the arrest rates and who is being arrested and who is being detained, who is being stopped, who is being shot down. So that we have an indication of who is doing what out there. The other thing that is clear is that folks need to be submitted to all kinds of psychological testing to be able to realize who is actually equipped to be of service and who should not. And also, the other issue is that we should not be supplying police departments out of surplus equipment that has come off the battlefields of Iraq and the battlefields of Afghanistan, and the grants to buy those kinds of weaponry that really begins to set you up as an assault unit rather than as a policing unit. And yes, of course, people should be come out of the local communities and should have the opportunities to come out of the local communities and serve.
That was Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. For more perspectives on the issues of police violence and racial division, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After 7 years, an independent investigation into the events surrounding the decision taken by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair to join the U.S. in launching the disastrous 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, has finally completed its work. The inquiry, named for Sir John Chilcot, the retired civil servant who was appointed by Tony Blair's successor, Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown, in 2009, to look into how the decision to enter the war was made, as well as the military conflict itself and its aftermath. These were among the findings of the report. The UK chose to join the invasion before peaceful options had been exhausted. Prime Minister Blair deliberately exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein and promised George Bush that he would be with him in the war, whatever. Other conclusions reached in the report included Britain's intelligence agencies produced flawed information, the UK military was ill-equipped for the task, and the government did not try hard enough to keep a tally of Iraqi civilian casualties. Your reporter spoke with David Swanson, author, activist, and journalist, who helped combat the U.S. corporate media blackout on the so-called British Downing Street memo that spelled out how the intelligence and facts justifying the Iraq War were to be fixed around the policy. Here Swanson summarizes the conclusions reached in the Chilcot report and considers the fact that the U.S. has had no similar inquiry to hold members of the George W. Bush administration accountable for their decision to launch the Iraq War under false pretenses and the subsequent commission of war crimes, including subjecting U.S.-held detainees to torture.
If you look at the details, the so-called findings, I mean, there's almost nothing new there that we didn't already know, much of it, you know, for a decade or more. But it establishes very clearly that Prime Minister Tony Blair was informed by his top advisors that the United States was intent on war, you know, at least a year before Blair or Bush led on to that fact, that the United States was lying about the justifications for the war, that Iraq had and could have no nuclear weapons, that if Iraq had any chemical or biological weapons, the only way it would use them would be if it were attacked, and the only way it would distribute it to them to any terrorists would be if it were attacked, that numerous other nations were of much greater concern than Iraq, North Korea among them, that attacking Iraq would be illegal, that an authorization from the United Nations did not exist and would be required, and of course they spent months trying to get one and didn't. You know, so it's a very damaging document. It also makes clear that the Joint Intelligence Committee in Britain, the so-called intelligence advisors, informed Blair and his cabinet that attacking Iraq would endanger the United Kingdom, would create chaos and disorder and terrorism rather than tamping down on it or protecting the United Kingdom and the United States. So they knew it would be counterproductive. They knew it would produce something like the disaster it produced. You know, so when Blair says now we wanted to save the Iraqi people from an evil dictator and bring them democracy, but they just weren't ready for it, and they went and destroyed their country, and we tried to help them, but they weren't mature enough to accept our help. You know, this is a new pile of lies. Right, because at the time, he admitted that overthrowing a government was illegal and pretended the war was about ridding Iraq of weapons that he knew it probably didn't have. And the idea that he had no reason to expect that the war would lead to something negative, you know, is disproven by the report. So, you know, all of which we already knew, and we knew from day one that Britain was a big accomplice in this crime, perhaps the greatest crime of the past 40 years, regardless of what excuses were made or who was being honest or who was lying. You know, possessing weapons is not a justification for a war and never could have been. So, you know, now we've done the report. They've dragged it out as long as they possibly could. Now we need accountability.
What is the next step in this report, given the fact that I just read that members of Parliament are calling for a vote to determine if Tony Blair is guilty of contempt of Parliament? Is that part of this process, and where do you think it will go?
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn, who is a terrific peace activist who had this right back in 2003 and earlier and ever since, and is now the leader of the Labour Party, has signed on to this measure that would hold Tony Blair in contempt or convict him of being contemptuous to Parliament, or however they phrase it, and you know, which is not a prosecution in a criminal court. It's not even exactly an impeachment, which is still possible as well, but it potentially carries the same penalty that might follow an impeachment and trial, which is barring Tony Blair from ever again holding public office. I mean, this is one of the things that could be done to George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or any other U.S. official, and then in both Britain and the U.S., people have been impeached in the past after having left office, and you can deny them benefits, deny them the right to ever hold office again, and so forth, but more importantly, condemn them publicly for their behavior.
As we look at the Chilcot report in Britain, it's obvious that the United States has had no similar investigation into the events surrounding the Bush administration's launch of the Iraq War. And upon taking office, President Barack Obama said famously, when he was asked about investigating the potential war crimes that occurred under the Bush administration, he said he was going to look forward and not look back. And the option of investigating what happened, not only about the Iraq War, but the torture that had been documented of U.S.-held prisoners, those issues have been taken off the table by Barack Obama himself. I wonder, David, if you would talk about any potential for an investigation to hold officials accountable and the danger you see in having elected officials who operate above the law and unaccountable to the public.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing and shameful that, you know, an accomplice or really almost a bit player in the biggest crime of the past 40 years or so, you know, is pursuing some modicum of accountability, some sort of truth and reconciliation to a very limited degree, and already in that process saw the results of having Parliament vote against a prime minister's demand for war for the first time in centuries 3 years ago with the proposal to send missiles into Syria. You know, whereas in the United States, there's nothing of the sort. And in fact, a woman I won't mention who couldn't get a nomination for president in the Democratic Party 8 years ago because she had voted for the invasion of Iraq now looks like she can. You know, there's this degree of forgetting because there hasn't been any accountability. And you have a candidate, another candidate I won't mention, actually running on a platform of more torture. Because the various atrocities, the murder and torture and imprisonment and spying during the course of this war have been treated as policy options, not as the crimes that they were.
That was activist and journalist David Swanson, whose books include War is a Lie and When the World Outlawed War. For more analysis of the Chilcot Report, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known by its acronym REGGIE, includes all the New England states plus New York, Maryland, and Delaware in a cap-and-trade program to reduce carbon emissions region-wide and raise money from the sale of pollution permits to fund green energy projects. The concept is that the cap on allowable emissions progressively decreases, thus reducing pollution. But critics say the problem with this and similar cap-and-trade programs is those very pollution permits, which allow companies to continue pouring both climate and ground-level pollution into the air, are mostly located in communities that are already heavily burdened by such pollution and are often low-income communities of color. Now an organization wants to use the program review process of REGGIE to push for including protections for these communities and to prioritize the funds raised to clean up the worst pollution, giving these communities a say in how the funds are spent. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Caitlin Parody, communications director with the group Toxics Action Center, who explains how a coalition of groups is working to make sure these climate justice initiatives are incorporated into the REGGIE process going forward.
This issue of fossil fuel pollution and climate change has really become a very important part of our work because of the experiences that frontline communities are having. And right now, REGGIE is actually going through a program review. And so we have been involved in forming a loose coalition to really take advantage of this moment and campaign to make sure that as the program evolves, we see really tough limits on pollution and that we see low-income communities, communities of color, and communities where fossil fuel infrastructure or environmental injustice have been concentrated, that they really have a say in what REGGIE looks like and how it's implemented and that they benefit from the program. And I think part of, you know, what that speaks to is this question of, okay, so you're driving down overall carbon pollution through REGGIE, that's great, but do we have local hotspots where maybe actually you have a lot of companies that are buying these permits instead of cleaning up their act in particular communities? And so one of the things that we really want to make sure is that concern is really honored and heard, and that as we go through this program review, an environmental justice analysis that includes, you know, analyzing proximity and cumulative impacts is part of the program review so that we can really make sure that, in fact, marginalized communities are benefiting from the program and not seeing any increase in localized emissions.
Caitlin Parody, I live in Connecticut, and we still have one coal-burning power plant left in Bridgeport, which the company is planning to replace in a few years with a gas-burning plant.
We have definitely have a long history of working in Bridgeport to help shut down Bridgeport Harbor Station. One of the asks that this loose coalition of groups is making is really that we set a stringent cap, overall cap on pollution. The specific ask is to set a cap that goes down 5% from 2020 levels every year through 2030. And one of the things that a strong cap like that can do is really help make sure that coal-fired power plants can't stay open, or in particular that they won't be refired with gas. And so it helps send this market signal that fossil fuel, you know, isn't the way to go, and also does kind of deal with this transition question where we don't see some of these coal-fired power plants that are going offline all over New England refired with gas. And then the other piece of this that I think is just so critical and really like where a lot of our involvement stems from is that we really want to make sure that the REGI process is accessible to frontline communities and communities that, like the community near the Bridgeport plant, that have just faced so much environmental injustice and lived with these smokestacks for years, so that they have a say both in how it's implemented and how its proceeds are distributed, and so that they're given assurance that a plant like Bridgeport isn't going to be more likely to stay open, isn't going to be able to buy all these permits or be refired with gas, you know, whatever it might be, that they have some assurances that they're going to have less pollution in their community because of REGI. And then we also ask that the money made through REGI, it should be heavily invested in communities that have dealt with the harmful health effects of fossil fuel power generation, again, like Bridgeport, and in programs that are really going to deliver benefits there.
I've talked to a lot of groups who are opposed to cap and trade, just opposed. Do you think your efforts are like putting lipstick on a pig, and that maybe it would be better to just oppose that system of pollution permits altogether and insist on, say, a straight-up carbon tax or carbon fee and dividend?
You know, I think that that's a totally valid critique, and there certainly are a lot of groups out there that are concerned that any trading program that allows polluters to buy permission to pollute is the status quo and is going to disproportionately harm low-income communities, communities of color, and the most vulnerable among us. So, you know, we do need a full paradigm shift. And right now we also have a real opportunity with the REGI program update to make incremental change and get us closer to the world that we want to see.
That was Caitlin Parody, Communications Director with the Toxics Action Center. Learn more about the effort to incorporate climate justice mandates into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.